Good morning, diners and travelers, and happy holidays to the whole culinary universe. We've been having a lot of feasting these days. Yeah, and we've lined up some really major treats for everybody today. We want to also say happy birthday to our son, whose birthday is actually on the 23rd.
Tomorrow. There we go.
Yeah.
And how about that?
So, actually, Adam has had one more Christmas than he has years.
And we've been playing word games with some of the dessert programs that we've assembled for you, and this is one of them, because everybody knows Marie Antoinette, the Empress, said, let them eat cake. Well, if she meant them to eat cake, she certainly would have wanted them to eat a cake that was made by Roger Pizzi, who is a fascinating chef, because not only is he a world expert on cakes, he also chefs at a restaurant at Stamford Bridge, the home of the Chelsea Football Club in London, England. So he's an interesting fellow, as you can tell.
I mean, I've had some major cake books, but this one's really extraordinary.
This one, as they say, takes the cake.
Yeah. Roger Pizzi. You know how to pronounce his name because you just wrote a book about cakes.
Oh, pies.
Anyhow, I mean, this is not just
a book
about cakes. This is called World Class Cakes, 250 classic recipes from Boston cream pie to madeleines and macaroons. And I can't even get my head around it, Roger. I don't know how you managed research and produce this book.
Well, it was incredible. It did take quite a while. It was an idea I'd had for a while, and then my publisher for my first book, which was Small Cakes, came up to me and asked me if I was interested in doing another. He had an idea, and we thought, well, let's try and do the ultimate cake book. It is the world's best cakes.
How did you figure that? Who said these are the world's best cakes? Who determined that?
Well, it's a determination of how you feel. I think what I tried to do is try to get the cakes that people recognize from around the world, but some are not so recognizable, and try to make them the best that they could be.
Okay, now, I mean, were most of these, like, part of your repertoire anyhow?
A lot of them were part of my repertoire, certainly the English and the French and some of the others, but a lot had to be researched and delved into, and I got 13 friends from around the world to add their little slice from they live, which was great help in bringing it all together. Just leaning on friends who come from different parts of the world to see what their favourite recipes, cakes were, and work from there.
Now, if you're into cake, you should buy this book. Not to have the recipes or anything like that, but just to know where the best places are to buy cake. In how many cities around the world?
In each section, there's places to eat places to eat great cakes from around the world. In cities from around the world. That's right.
So you've got Tokyo, you've got Singapore, you've got Melbourne, you've got Sydney,
New York,
you've got London, you've got Paris.
Yeah.
Which is the top?
Well,
I mean, a lot of people would say Austria.
Yeah, a lot of people say Austria. A lot of people say Paris. I think, you know, London is holding its own at the moment. We've got some great stuff going on now. You know, there's some great artisan bakeries. There's some great little pastry shops coming on. Peyton and Byrne doing a really good job at what they're doing. And then you got Sydney and Melbourne. They've got Adria over there who's doing a fantastic job.
Now, just briefly, can you sum up some of your experience, because you've had some significant experience. You just didn't pop out of the woodwork with this book.
No, I started my career about 23. Before that, I was a herdsman. I used to work on a farm and milk cows.
Really?
And I thought...
Our English nephew married a Mongolian MD, and he herds goats in Mongolia.
Wow, fantastic.
So you were a herdsman, and then what?
And then I left, and I went. I was learning how to cook by a good friend of mine who worked on the farm, and I decided to take it a stage further, so I went to college, and I came out of it, and then I thought, okay, I don't really know a lot, so I wrote to the 10 best restaurants in the country, asking for a job. They wrote to the Gavroche, which is a 3-star Michelin then, and Albert Roux was running, and they sent me a letter back saying they have a 2-year waiting list, but you can work. We have places in Rue restaurants. So I went down to London. I started in Rue Britannia, which is part of their sous vide empire, as it was doing then, because they were in the vanguard of doing sous vide food. Worked there for a year, and then ended up working at the Gavroche after about 9 months, and after 2 years, I was the pastry chef.
So you knew what you were doing, because Albert sure knows what he's doing, huh?
Albert certainly knows what he's doing, yeah, and he was on the path at that point, and he was running the kitchen with Stephen Doherty, and he retired, and Michel Roux Jr., which, of course, doing fantastic now, he was then running the kitchen, and I left in 1990, having Marco Pierre White come for dinner and tasted the tart tatin that I was making there and decided he would buy the pastry chef.
No kidding. So you were at the Oak Room with him?
I started at Harvard's.
Oh, okay, all right.
Yeah, I started at Harvard's, and I left the Gavroche on the Friday night. We had a 3-star. I started Saturday morning at Harvey's restaurant, which was a 2-star, which was a 1-star, but we just got our 2-star, and we did the opening launch with the Michelin Guide. We do lunch there for the Michelin Guide people.
Okay, and so then you got
1 and 2 in 2 days.
And then you got.
And we're there until we moved to the restaurant at the Hyde Park.
Okay.
And then we got our 3-star there. Well, and then from then it was all. We used to be up with the Criterion, the Mirabel, Quo Vadis, Belvedere.
You were Quo Vadis. The Hearts are friends of ours.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they took over. They bought the place.
They're doing a really good job with it, too, by the way.
They are doing a fantastic job.
Well, they hired, what's his name?
Jeremy Lee from Blueprint Cafe.
That's right, Jeremy Lee.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
He's fabulous, yeah.
He's doing a great job. He really is. He's had some fantastic reviews.
You even have, Nancy Silverton's olive oil cake in here.
That's right. I met Nancy in the mid-90s when I came over to L.A. When I went to La Notte, Albert sent me to La Notte for a week just because I've done quite well, so it was a little treat to send me there. And I met a lady from L.A. there that used to work for Nancy. And so when we came over to L.A., we got in touch and we went to La Brea restaurant, the Campanile then, as it were. And we had dinner and had a chat, and she ended up giving me a bag of bread, and we kept in contact.
Yeah, that's great.
People forget how long she's been doing this. I mean, she was really a pioneer.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, that's a play on words. You're a pioneer with a book about cakes.
Yeah.
And
I missed
She sent me a book. She signed me a book. She said, "Don't stop eating cake, eat bread." That was a La Brea bakery book.
Now, we've never managed to go to Mark Hicks's place at all.
Oh, okay.
Now, what's this oyster ale cake?
His oyster ale cake is classic. It's oyster ale because it's Mark Hicks's oyster ale. So it's like a porter ale, basically.
Okay, so it's like a really... It's designed to go with oysters.
Yeah, that's right. It's a dark ale.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's funny, one of the things we found out in Ireland, just by the way, and listeners, I might forget to include this somewhere in our conversation, but Anne kept on complaining that she couldn't get oysters in restaurants there. And they said, well, oysters are really pub food. You go in and you drink a pint of Guinness, and you eat a dozen oysters, and then if you're still hungry, you drink another pint of Guinness, and then you eat a plate of mussels, but then you're done.
Yeah, that's it. There's a lot of iron going down there, isn't there?
There is.
Now, how is this organized? I mean, I just wander through this book, I mean, and it's like, here's on one page, it's Japanese strawberry shortcake, which I never knew existed. And the next page is bee sting cake, and I don't know what that is. And then we have hummingbird cake. I mean, this is an encyclopedia of cakes.
It is. It is. It's trying to get through it's like we've sectioned it off to sponges and layers and fruit and nuts and celebratory and going through the recipes and making them as we were going and developing them. And, you know, there was a few tragedies and we've built on that one. There were the nemesis as well that I was wanting to keep, you know, at the back. They were on the list, but I kept putting them back. You know, the croque en bouche and the Davos. You know, they're not easy. But anyone who buys this book can realize that there's some really, really simple ones, like the Welsh cake and just a lemon drizzle that you can start off if you've not had much experience baking cakes. They really are very simple and very tasty.
And you also have these photographed step-by-step things.
Yes, that's right, just to help people along. And then it gets more complicated into the cassatura, which is, you know, it is basically a stellar sponge cake, but it was the awakira. It's the folding, it's the movement of the spoon to release the air bubbles and the spraying every 3 minutes. You know, it's very Japanese, very regimental in a way.
Now, you have some cupcakes in there, but
yes.
The cupcakes had a craze here in the United States. I don't know if they did had a similar one in London. Is there something displacing them, do you think, in the cake world?
Do you know, it's funny because I left Margot for a couple of years to work for a guy called Oliver Payton, and we opened the Payton and Byrne Bakeries over there, over here in London. And we started to do cupcakes. Boy, this is 9 years ago now. And it was a case of we were doing them, and Oliver said, you know, this is just a fad. We were doing 800 a week, and then we're doing 1,200 a week. And
oh, they're not going away.
They're not going away. No. And I think people have just, they've gone full circle. Whoopie pies, they haven't done it over here. They've not really made it. But, you know, cupcakes are still doing very well.
How about cronuts?
People have gone on to eclairs now.
Do you have cronuts?
Oh, they're trying.
You're trying?
There's only so much fat you can eat.
That's not really a cake, is it? Anyway,
cronut.
It's a croissant. It's between a donut and a croissant.
Croissant, yeah.
It's not really a cake.
Pastry cream in the center.
I'm going to ask you, is there still room for an inventive chef to create something called a peach melba or something called a pavlova? But I guess they're pies, they're not cakes anyway.
No, that's right. I think they're always trying, but I think they're just hybrids, aren't they? It's like a cockapoo in dog world.
Cockapoo.
Well, where are we going next? Where are we going with this?
Well, tell our listeners your opinion. It's probably better informed than ours is.
Well, I think people are always going to try different styles and push a boundary, but at the end of the day, we come back to basics of a basic cake or a basic sponge, or we've got a tart and we put a top on it and we call it a pie. It's just what goes around comes around, and everyone starts suddenly going retro again, and we're back to square one. I think fundamentally, if you just do the basics and build yourself up from that and get your own knowledge and get yourself equipped mentally in making cakes and baking, I think you're fine without having to break boundaries and play around with the DNA.
Well, here's a classic, devil's food cake, okay? Oh. I mean, can anything beat a devil's food cake? Now, this devil's food cake in this book looks 1,000 times better than any devil's food cake I've ever seen. Does that mean that it's that much better, the recipe?
Well, looks are the first thing, aren't they? As soon as when you're presented with a plate of food, the first thing that hits you is the eye contact, the eye candy. Does it look beautiful? Yes. Then taste it. Try it. Make it. It's absolutely stunning. It's an old recipe, really old buttercream recipe of mine, which I've stood the test of time. I won't change. And the sponge is fantastic and lovely and rich.
So what's the definitive recipe? I mean, we have people making these devil's food cakes in the States with mayonnaise in them.
Right. You know,
beetroot.
There you go again.
Yeah, I know.
If they were doctors, they'd have three-armed people walking around. But it's a bit strange, isn't it? People always want to try and put different things in. Before we go,
we must introduce. Is it a new trend that you're a part of, that there's a fine dining restaurant in a Premier League soccer stadium?
Well, we've been there for 7 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. We've been there for 7 years. Mr. Abramovich decided that, thankfully, that he wanted a fine dining in a football stadium.
And it's called Marco Grill.
It's called Marco Grill.
And it's in the Stamford Bridge, Chelsea Football Club Stadium, yes?
Yeah, and you can get to us by info@marcogrill.com.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, all the way from across the big pond.
Thank you very much.
We'll be over at Christmas time, and we'll at least wave to you.
Yeah.
And you've got celebration coming up for Thanksgiving next month, haven't you?
We do indeed.
Maple syrup and pecan layer cake that's in there. It's fantastic.
Which one is
it? Pecan layer cake.
Oh, okay. All right.
It's maple syrup and pecan layer.
Okay. Well, we're going to be in pecan country territory, because we're going to go visit our kids who live in South Carolina.
Okay.
And so maybe I'll send my daughter-in-law this recipe. I've cooked very elaborate things. But I've never been a baker. My mother was a baker, and I think that's part of it, because I never had to bake. But, you know, you're so inspirational with this book.
Thank you.
This is not cake. I mean, this is art.
See, it wasn't really Marie Antoinette. It was really Roger Pisey who said, "Let him eat cake."
That's right.
Oh, I can't let you go without asking you about this Cran Sicacca.
Caca.
What is it?
It's about 14 feet tall.
That's right. It is.
It's Scandinavian.
It's a monument, and it was we had to take it down. You make it in layers, and then you ice it, and it's 16. It's incredible. It's quite a monument to put together for the photo shoot, and it looks great, doesn't it? It looks absolutely stunning, and it tastes really nice, and you just spread it out. It's quite more biscuity than cakey, and I just think you could celebrate, and you could put flowers on it, and all sorts of things. And
did you know about that before you wrote the research of this book?
Yeah.
And you, of course, have the ultimate croquembouche, too.
Yes, the ultimate croquembouche.
With pansies, or are they violets?
Yeah. Violets.
Violets, are they, or...
I always think of my blushing groom whenever I see the roses bloom or something.
Violet blue. Oh, boy, I could just go on. I mean, one of these is more stunning than the next.
Well, they're the hard ones.
You even have the king's cake. I'll be darned. Have you been to New Orleans?
No, I've been to New Orleans.
Okay, they have king's cake.
They do good cake down there, too. You should go there sometime.
Yeah.
Come visit us and stay a while and
cook.
Bake.
Cook some cakes for us.
Okay. I'll bring my apron.
Yeah, bring your apron. We actually could lend you an apron.
Oh, that's nice.
We have one that's modeled after, you put it on and you look like Michelangelo's David.
Oh, do you?
And we also,
that might be a bit small for me.
We also have one that has a carrot in the same place.
Exactly. They're all presents to him, so you know what kind of man he is.
We're going downhill here. It's time to go.
Oh, Roger.
Thank you so much.
Oh, it was great just meeting you and talking to you, and thank you for this really glorious book.
My pleasure.
And we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Next up, a section I absolutely adored working on as a segment on pies, a very particular segment, and I think we all enjoyed this. I outlined it pretty thoroughly at the introduction to the interview, so let's go to Kate's and Kate's Pies. We have two Kates on the line today. That's not such an original opening, but we do have Kate McDermott, who is an old friend of ours, as well as our new friend, Kate Lebo. And the commonality here is called pie. P-I-E. And both you Kates, I don't know that you realize, but you're talking to a pie person. In my family, we never had birthday cakes. We had blueberry pie. So anyhow, you two are interconnected, and I wanted you to explain how you found each other and what is the connection. How about Kate McDermott first?
Oh, gosh. Well, thank you so much for having us both on your program today, Anne. It's a pleasure to be here. And I know that I'm always happy to talk about pie, and I can't imagine that my dear friend Kate Lebo is not feeling the same way herself. Kate and I met, oh, gosh, it must be 5 or 6 years ago, I think, now. And, of course, it was over pie. And I can't remember the exact class or demonstration or workshop or whether there were just people in the Seattle food community, which is a wonderful and vibrant community, who just said, you two have got to meet. And we did.
I remember.
Kate, do you remember anything?
I do. Well, first I found you online because there was another woman in Seattle named Kate making pie. So I had to find out this doppelganger of mine. And I looked up your website, and you had this incredible collection of books that you were suggesting people read about pie. And I immediately went to the library and to the bookstore and found a bunch of them. I was like, I have to meet this lady. So I heard that you were doing a workshop, a very like quick demo, and I got myself there. I, just like you said, I got to meet this really warm collection of people in the food community in Seattle, and I met you, and I gave you a copy of the zine that, now the full-length book, A Commonplace Book of Pie. Then someone gifted me, some secret admirer gifted me a class of yours.
That's right. I do remember that. I do. Oh, my gosh, that was such fun.
It was fun. It's pretty magical.
Now, back up a minute. Now, how long have you been doing your pie thing, Kate McDermott?
Well, I've baked all my life, and I baked pies when I lived on a blueberry U-pick on the Olympic Peninsula. The farmer had asked you, can you bake some pies, and we'll take these to the, he wanted to take the pies to the Grange bake sale, which was a donation. And I said, sure. So, you know, I've been baking pies for decades, but it wasn't until probably in the early 2000s, around 2004, 2003, that I really started to get the pie bug of, let me see how much I can do with crust and dough. And about 2006, it was becoming a little bit of an obsession where I was making sometimes 4 and 5 different types of crusts a day to see what made a great crust and a great pie. And then I started teaching when I kind of settled on a dough and technique that really seemed to be working well. People said, can you teach me this? So I said, well, sure, come on over to the house. And that started Art of the Pie.
And now you have the classes and you have your blog, right?
Yes, I have a number of things. I've got my Art of the Pie half-day workshops. I have my blog. I have a website, artofthepie.com. And then I recently have started doing multi-day pie camps for those who really want to just immerse themselves into as much pie pastry, pie history, pie lore, pie baking as they can. And we have a fabulous time.
You know, that got my attention. We have a cousin in England who went to dessert camp. So, it was a totally new idea to me, but, you know, I'd love, what goes on at pie camp?
Well, we meet at several places. I have one pie camp that's on Whidbey Island and then another one that is in Montana. The one on Whidbey Island, we meet and get settled in, have an opening dinner, all the meals are catered. And then the next day, which is the first full day of the camp, I demonstrate 4 or 5 different doughs. Then after lunch, we start playing by making, rolling them out. We make hand pies. We learn about all sorts of edges and flutes and lattice work. We'll make mini pies. We do different fillings and talk about different thickeners and have demonstrations on that and play with it. We even have an ice cream making demonstration session. One night we'll have movie night and we watch the ultimate pie movie, Waitress. We ask people to bring their, if they choose to, if they have a favorite apron that has a history to it, we ask to bring that and maybe talk about the history or why that is important. Or sometimes people will bring a very special rolling pin with them that has lots of history for them. And we talk about, you know, we have pie history, pie stories, and we even have pie crafts, which is awfully fun also.
So the difference is that pie class is like a half-day thing, and pie camp is sort of like a really intensive absorption in pies.
Yes. So, pie camp, we are eating, breathing, dreaming about as many different pies and things that we can do with them as possible. And everyone goes home with their freshly baked pie to different parts of the country. They walk right on the plane with their pies. It's their carry-on. They place it right underneath the seat in front of them in a nice little box. And the Art of the Pie class, the workshop, is about a 5-hour workshop that takes place all over the country, or also I teach it out of my home, which is called Pie Cottage in Port Angeles on the Olympic Peninsula.
Oh. Isn't Port Angeles where the guy who wanted to blow up Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport came in from Canada carrying his load of stuff?
Yes, but I've heard that story, and I do believe that the folks at our border, which I'm right across from Victoria, British Columbia, the folks who are the our federal employees who are screening are excellent. And there was a woman who was one of the screeners who did catch that man.
Oh, great! I hope you baked her a pie in celebration.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Okay, well, we're glad she did. She deserves a lifetime supply of pies.
No, yes, she does. We jump to Kate Lebo, and she is a published poet and also a creative writing teacher, and you also teach about pies.
Indeed.
So this book is what set me off. I want to say this commonplace book of pie. It's little, it's square, which is really appealing, I think. And as far as I can say, it would make the most perfect gift for somebody. It has not only pie stories, references, quotations about pie, but it also has, you'll have to explain what I'm saying, I think, Kate Lebo.
The one thing about it that's very clear is that the last thing it is commonplace.
Yes.
I don't know what the opposite of commonplace is, but that's the word that should be on the front.
I mean, you make up horoscopes for people who like the different kinds of pies, and but you do have recipes, too. And you have, what do you call them, these little, they're hints that are, they're funny. You have a section on mud pies. Tell us your take on what was your intention with this book?
Well, sure. So I call a commonplace book of pie a collection of facts, both real and imagined, pie. And it imagines that your favorite pie has something to say about who you are. It's influenced by the idea of a commonplace book, which is a form that was really popular in early modern Europe and continues today. Some people say that blogs are a new form of a commonplace book. And all it is a book where you keep recipes, quotes, poems, thoughts, things that you don't want to lose, things that you want to gather in one place and go back to later and use someplace else. So my commonplace book of pie is this curated collection of stuff from the culture about pie and poems about pie with the intention of making this book that is a book of poems but ends up in the cookbook section. So people who love food, people who love pie, find a book of poems, approach it for the pie, and leave with something that they didn't expect.
Now, it seems to me that in the pie world, which must be a relatively small world of professional pie people, the two of you would be competitors. You wouldn't be working together at all. You'd be saying, how can I do better than this person? How can I steal more of the pie for myself? So go figure.
Well, you know, one of the things that Kate teaches that makes me really excited about pie and about her method in general is that she is very much about the senses and about the hands and about like looking at what's in your bowl and feeling your way through it and kind of accepting whatever you end up making and then making another one. So there's this real generosity of spirit to the way that she teaches that I then commandeered into not only my own pie school but my artistic process with this emphasis again, like when you're writing a poem, to think about the senses. How does the world get in to you? You know, it's your eyes, it's your hands.
We had a recent guest talked about the fact that she couldn't deal with food if she didn't get her hands in it.
Oh, that was Lydia Bastianich.
Yeah, and I'm guessing you must feel exactly the same way.
Absolutely. I mean, when people love to make jokes about cake versus pie and say, what, you know, why is pie better? And if I had to answer that question, it's because you don't mix a cake with your hands. But the best pie is made with your hands. So there's that gift that is like literally touched into the dough. And I think that that's what makes pie really magical.
Yeah, you were going to read us like one of your little entries.
Sure.
I should mention also that your illustrations are just gorgeous.
Thank you. Those are by Jessica Lynn Bonin.
Yes.
Who is equally obsessed with handmade things.
Now, she ought to be called Kate, too. Very, very push through a name change, I think.
She sounds fascinating. It says she lives and works in a former hardware store and lumber yard in Edison, Washington.
It's called the Lucky Dumpster. It is a treasure trove of handmade crafts.
I agree. I've been there. It's fabulous.
Well, isn't it time for a pie poem?
Yeah, we're going to do mincemeat pie.
Got it. So mincemeat pie. Only one woman alive today would say her favorite pie is mincemeat. She makes hers with green tomatoes and mixed assorted meat stuff. Her grandchildren hide her slices in their mouths and spit them into milk glasses when she gets up to answer the telephone. No, thank you. Now is not a good time. She wanted to be a writer. She took photographs and painted, or Isadora-colored scarves that covered her hair like hair. was the most beautiful woman in town, and justifiably vain. She likes to imagine her movements as gusts of wind blowing her children around the world. Her little book.
I mean, I'm so moved by this book and the whole concept.
Now, are you actually making us, do you have a recipe for a savory mince pie?
Absolutely not.
Oh, you don't? Okay.
This isn't an autobiographical book. That's not me.
No, it's just that you were hinting at it, and the true mincemeat pie appears to be disappearing.
Right.
What is in its place is what you call a dried fruit mince pie. When in fact the original mince was exactly that. It was made out of meat. But you don't have a meat recipe.
Don't. You know, my obsession is double crust fruit pie.
Yeah, me
when
too.
I'm making pie, but then when I'm writing about it, my imagination can conjure anything.
There you go.
Right?
I mean, the book is filled with all kinds of enjoyable tidbits, such as how to eat a pie with a fork and plate, preferred by polite company and mothers speaking to children, with your face, preferred by the fat kid, the skinny kid, the kid with sinus problems from winning pie eating contests. Well, I mean, I think people will get the general idea. This is a serious book, but it's also a book with a lot of whimsy, wit, and humor in it. And knowing Kate McDermott as I do, she's a person with the same kind of qualities. I was so glad to meet you, Kate McDermott, and I'm glad to welcome you into this community, Kate Lebo.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah. And
thank you.
Yeah, and someday I'll make it to Pie Camp.
Yeah, you might make it to Whidbey
Island. I hope you will. There will always be a place for you.
There we go. Well, where's the closest one to Pittsburgh?
No, you have to go there.
You have to go there to do Pie Camp.
Who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows where pie will take us? Pie is an absolutely amazing ambassador. It's just continues to be an incredible ride of just meeting the best people, meeting people who just love what they're doing and just open their homes and their hearts to do something with their hands and to give that to someone else is just such a gift.
Well, now,
Kate's absolutely right.
Yeah, you conclude our conversation with a lady who should have the last word on the subject. Her name is Marie Antoinette. And she, everybody knows she said, let them eat cake, but in fact she said, let them eat pie.
Thank you both.
So one of the projects of the book, something that's very important to me, is to kind of trace the lineage of both pie making and the creative act, the way that we owe so much to our influences and to our teachers. And the way when you make something, you're taking the lessons of someone who came before you to make something new. So the way that I did that was to start the book with this mention that says, what a wise baker once said, the goal is pie. And then there's a recipe, just one recipe for crust later. It says, as taught to the author by a wise baker. And at the very end, I say the wise baker is Kate McDermott. The idea being that I know that pie is this thing I have learned from the women who came before me, from my mother and tips from Kate and tips from other women, and that a recipe is this thing that is passed down from person to person and tweaked, some to much greater effect than others. For example, once Kate McDermott gets her hands on a recipe, it's a totally different thing, right?
You're so sweet. Thank you so much.
Tears
to my eyes.
Oh, well, yeah.
Okay.
That's the story.
There is such a warm camaraderie between the pie makers across this country. I've just found everyone to be so generous and kind with sharing and knowledge. We even have a small group on Facebook called Pie Nation of pie makers from all over the place, and we freely share information without any egos getting in the way. It's just, what works for you? What pie pan do you like? Did you try this? And I've learned so much from there, and it's just a great place. I know Kate's a member of that group also. Kate Lebo's a member of that group. And I think if I could share one important tip with your listeners about making pie, it is to keep everything chilled, but especially yourself.
That's a thought for the day. I think we should have Pie Nation get together with Barack Obama and the guy from Iran, and the three of you could solve all the world's problems in an afternoon of pie class.
I agree.
Yes, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And may your pies continue to come out just exactly the way you want them to, and may all your troubles be little ones.
And don't ever use and don't use Crisco in
your
crust. Be happy,
make pie.
Thank you.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
So you're having a party, and you want to do something a little bit different, but not so different that it takes up your whole time. We have the chef for you, Chef Eric Levine, known as the Chef's Chef, and he has a book that will give you all the little savory bites you need. Small bites, big flavor with Chef Eric. Eric Levine. Yeah. Is such an accomplished chef. You've just plowed your way even through periods of adversity and managed to catch awards, run businesses, and now you have this book, which is called Small Bites, Big Flavor, and it's exactly that. It's subtitled Simple, Savory, and Sophisticated Recipes for Entertaining, and I guess entertaining is what is the definitive direction of the book, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It's a grouping of recipes from hors d'oeuvres to medium plates, entrees, desserts, and even cocktails.
Yeah, you have cocktails in the back. I forgot about
that.
That's
important. Small bites.
Absolutely.
Small bites, you're going to have cocktails with small bites, right?
That's right.
Now, Eric, I was really impressed with whoever styled your food.
Well, that was myself and one of my business partners, Tony Colarco. So he's a photographer, and we did all the designs and styling together.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah,
but so is this what the dishes actually look like on the plate when you get them at your restaurant?
Yes, yes. For the, the hors d'oeuvres are more for the past hors d'oeuvre cocktail stations, but the entree stuff is exactly that. So now, we rotate, yeah.
You're serving selections of platters and skewers and spoons and whatever, sporks, are very impressive. Asian. And is there an Asian strain that runs through your taste buds?
Well, you know what? I tend to, just from the flair standpoint, from the design elements, I love the Asian culture. I think Japan, just knowing how the culture works, and there's a lot of detail to it, but there's also very straight lines and very forced direction, which I think is great. I think food should have an impact, but also have that softness to it. So I think throughout the book, that definitely comes out and definitely plays a big role in it. And that was an important part in designing the layouts. But for the entrees, it's about the free flow, having flavors to be able to blend and match together and be served together in some fun presentations. There's, in using the skewers and sticks, a company called Pick on Us.
Yes, you quoted that. Referenced them in your book.
Yep, I referenced them in the book. The great company. We're actually working on some party picks packets to be able to sell in retail shops, and so people could create these recipes and more, and be able to display it kind of like the pros do.
Yeah, well, some of your small plates, they look like little presents, the way they're wrapped up, packaged.
When you're looking at that, it looks like Oreos with basil on the side.
That's not Oreos. Different. That's not what I was.
That's not Oreos with basil on the side.
No, well, I was looking at these small bites.
Yeah, well, when you look at small bites, that's how they should be. That little burst of flavor, that little package, that little present that you're giving to your guests, and besides the hokey pokey, that's what it's about.
Okay, now I know about small plates, and I wanted to ask you about your large plates. Are they like meant to be shared from a buffet table, or how are they served?
Well, the focus of it is to be able to share as a family, family style, and or if it's just a dinner for two, presenting it in that fashion. So, the recipes are anywhere from 4 to 6 servings. So if you're having a group of people at your house and you want to do it family style, that's a great way to do it. You can put it if you have like a smaller chafing dish at home and cut them up into smaller bites so people could pick from lots of different selections. That's another way to go. And throughout the book, there's ways of changing the recipes. There's other ideas to enhance. So instead of using pork, you can use chicken. Instead of using scallops, you can use sea bass. And yeah. It just shares different ways of doing that.
What I like in this, too, it's you have your chef's notes, which I think are always helpful. Like such as you can put together this, all the components a day or two ahead of time, and then before filling one in the oven, etc. Then you have variations, which you were just talking about. Spinach dip or hummus can be used instead of crab mix.
Absolutely.
And then you have something that I don't see very often. It's implied frequently, but it's best season. This item is best for spring and summer, for example.
Yeah, you know, I think all too often we forget about seasons because food is relatively available all year round. Specifically things like asparagus. My restaurant or my bakery, you'll never see anything that is out of season. We won't use asparagus, you know, after August. And before the end of May, beginning of June. It's seasonality. And it's, I think for us as a restaurant, we try to share in that season. I think you can get more things out of the season by paying attention to local farms. Even the Farmer's Almanac, that'll help out a great deal.
Right.
People get so used to having, you go to a restaurant in the middle of the winter and get asparagus, but there's no flavor. The quality is very wood-like. So we try to stay away from those things. And I think throughout the cookbook, I try to really keep it so that you can really stay focused on the season and what's good during the fall, what's good during the spring, what's good during the summer and the winter, just kind of having fun with food, making it so that it's at its peak and at its lowest cost. That's another advantage.
What you specify yield, which seems to be something, and we get a lot of cookbooks, it seems to have gone out of style in cookbooks, and I don't know how you can make something without indicating how many portions there is.
Yeah, you know, that has seemed to be a trend.
Why? It seems so bizarre.
Yeah, well, you know what, as a chef, I know for me, I'm always thinking on the fly and trying to, okay, use this amount, and sometimes I really have to be specific and give the exact recipe. Because people's, you know, everyone's perception of a cup is different.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone has a different flow for that. So, you know, when people are measuring, they have to look at the proper size cups, gallons, quarts. And, you know, for me, it's having the consistency. So as a restaurant, we have that consistent product coming out.
Now, you also rate these at the skill level needed. 1, 2, and 3.
Oh, yeah.
I couldn't find any threes. I probably didn't look
closely. There's a couple of threes peppered in there.
I just hit on one, actually.
Yeah.
The grilled and chilled asparagus skewered shrimp.
I looked at that
for a long time, figuring out how the hell did he get this asparagus through the shrimp?
That's why it's a level 3. It takes a delicate hand. You know, in my first cookbook, Stick and Spoon and Put in a Glass, everything was at a level 3. I really couldn't sell it to the public. It was more geared towards the industry.
Uh-huh.
So for us, when Lions Press approached us to write the cookbook, it was, okay, we have to make this more simplified, make it so that the average home cook can make it with ease instead of having to go to the store and finding all these complicated things that aren't normally available in the molecular world. So keeping it simple is the best way we found.
Yeah. So you had another book before this.
Yes, it's called Stick and Spoon and Put in a Glass, and it was published by an organization called CaterSource. And the focus of the cookbook was to make it to write a cookbook for chefs. When I wrote that book, it was to offer a book that I was looking for. So everything being done in that book was done in threes. So it's a tuna, soy, and avocado. I did it. I offered that three different recipes. One on a stick, one on a spoon, and one on a glass.
That's a little bit like Michael Minnan did that at his restaurant in the West End. Things came in, they had special serving plates made.
Right. Oh, you know, that's a whole different thing. That's, you know, the Grand Echelon things at Alinea. You know, that is way above even the level that Stick was put together in, because it was just, their stuff is so, like, amazing and gorgeous and so much fun to play with. Me, my customers wouldn't be able to, not understand it, but wouldn't appreciate the way they would the more earth-focused foods.
Now, these are bold recipes. I picked up on one. It's the savory donuts.
Yes.
But the first item on the list of ingredients is 6 tablespoons of sugar. Now,
yes.
I have to tell you, the Haig household uses 6 tablespoons full of sugar
every 10 years.
About every 2 years. We buy a bag of sugar, and the only reason we have to buy another one is because the stuff that's in the sugar bowl got all crunchy.
Right.
The only time we buy sugar is when atoms come out.
So these are recipes with gutsy, but follow them carefully to make sure they're going to come out right.
Yeah, well, it's definitely a good challenge for the home cook. Not too far off the beaten path, but definitely challenging. You know, we want them to have fun with cooking. You know, it'd be easy to take it out of a box and throw it in the oven or the microwave.
I'm still a little confused about what constitutes a mid-bite. I've never heard of that one.
Well, mid-bite would be anything you put out when you're having guests over before dinner, something that could be a dip or some type of soup or something simple that everyone could kind of enjoy from a communal standpoint. So you'll have little bites that you could that are not just a one-biter, mm-hmm. but a few bites, and everyone could share in that.
So the small bites are sort of, you come up, shove them in your mouth, and get another one.
Exactly.
And
with the medium bites, you could go back often and on eating. Okay. We have several different things in there.
And then the large bites are real sort of platefuls.
Yep, absolutely. So it's more focus on the entree, and then you have the desserts, and of course the cocktails, because why shouldn't you have cocktails?
Yeah, what's your favorite? What's your favorite cocktail?
Ooh, that's a hard one for me. From the book, I mean, you know, they're all kind of fun for different reasons. Really, it'd be, for me, I think the hibiscus and gin is nice because it has a real floral flavor to it.
Okay, yes. Yeah.
The lavender honey limoncello, it's a really nice one. There is one that we have with a ginger sweet tea vodka, ginger smash. That's probably my favorite because, one, I love tea. All types of tea. I drink tea all the time.
Okay.
I'm not a big coffee drinker, so, you know, my day starts off with a cup of Lipsang Souchong. So I have a little fresh, you know, nice tea in the morning, but I'll drink tea all day. You know, whether it's green tea or African black, I enjoy tea. So I figured, how about infusing it into an alcoholic beverage? And lo and behold, this came out of it.
There you go. And there's some ginger in there too, right?
There's ginger. There's vodka. I think to make you smile.
I bet you smile a lot. Huh?
Oh yeah.
I can.
Well, not as much as I used to, but now for different reasons.
I can see you at the other end of the microphone. feeling like this interview is going really well, and I'm really enjoying myself, and I have a smile on my face.
Always. You got to smile, right? Life is way too short not to smile.
There you go. I'm sure that's true. And this is a fine contribution. Second book along. Is there a third coming along behind it?
Well, I think there's a couple more that I want to play with. One will be definitely focused on desserts. I have this hankering to create a whole dessert cookbook, and then one is going to be something that will play on the more of the trends that are going on now, bacon and burgers and different combinations of food. So we have a lot of that going on here at my restaurant, but I want to offer those recipes because we get a lot of people asking for our different products that we serve here, and I said, well, why not write a cookbook on that? But that's down the line.
Yeah, but if you're lazy and all you want to do is eat wonderful food cooked by Chef Eric, you can go to Morris Tap and Grill in Randolph, New Jersey, and you can get an instant fix without having to do any work.
That's right. Let me do the work for you.
Right.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, and we wish you continued success with your restaurant and with your developing ideas. It seems like you're kind of an ingenious kind of guy, so I'm sure we're gonna hear from you again.
I appreciate you folks. Have a great weekend, and God bless.
Thanks, Eric. Bye-bye.
And don't go away, because we have a final segment for today right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are, and next stop is, the Cowgirls, or at least one of them is Peggy Smith, is going to talk to us about this Cowgirl Creamery Cooks book, which, reading it, you're going to get a whole history of the development of the organic farmstead cheese making in this country, as well as some delicious recipes utilizing, of course,
cheese. And of course, we're introducing it here in particular because what easier hors d'oeuvre could you serve to your party group than cheese
or
cheese-related stuff?
In case,
desserts are after, I guess. Anyway, we hope you'll enjoy this track as well.
Well, we have half of the Cowgirl girl creamery, we have Peggy Smith.
Which do we have, the front legs or the back legs?
Yeah. It's a rather ingenious cover. Peggy's partner is Sue Conley. He's not going to be there. You have a knockout photography team, too.
Hershey and Hamilton.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So the cookbooks, Cowgirl Creamery Cooks, which is a slightly different take on what you're known for in a way.
Right.
It has this cutout. Cookbooks are going ingenious lengths to differentiate themselves, and that's pretty cute with the cowboy and the hat the person. I guess that's you with a hat.
Yeah, they were able to recreate our little logo on the book, which is fun.
Right.
Now, and is that really you on the horse?
No. She's a little bit thinner than I am.
Now, you're real famous for your cheese shop and the cheeses you make yourself and the wonderful cheeses you bring in from around the world from other suppliers as well, but that's not exactly cooking.
Right, but Sue and I both come from cooking backgrounds.
Trained cook.
Before we started making cheese, we were cooks.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Okay, so you're
serious, like Chez Panisse.
I understand. Okay, well, I didn't know that, and besides, our listeners didn't know that, so I wanted to make sure they heard it.
Right.
Right.
Basically, Peggy, you give an overview on how you got all this started, and I was reading it, and I'm thinking, you know, their history is the history of the whole establishment of the American cheese-making institution in America. I mean, of serious world-class cheeses. I mean, the characters are all the big names, the big heroes in cheese. It really documents the development of a cheese culture, which before then we never had.
Right. You know, the people that started making cheese before us, most of them are just so willing to give information out, and a lot of people helped us with what we were doing and helped us in how to move forward. And we were really lucky to have those people before us who were so kind to give us so much of their time and expertise.
Yeah, I mean, the Strauss family moved right in to help, huh?
Yeah, we wanted to use their, when Albert opened his creamery, you know, his family had a dairy, but Albert opened the creamery and transitioned organic, and so it just gave us a good opportunity to work with some really delicious milk to make cheese.
Just for credibility, but just, I mean, I found it very impressive that you were the first women, was it, and among the first American cheesemakers to be admitted into the big World Cheese Society.
A few that came before us, and they just opened it up to, there were people like Judy Shad, who has a company called Capriol. Yeah, and she makes fantastic cheese and has always been a big supporter and a huge help for anyone, for most anyone who's opening a cheese making facility. But she was admitted before us, and Kathy Strange, and there were others. But we were just flabbergasted when they asked us if we wanted to join.
You were just right off the plane in your blue jeans. And
I know, in our normal attire. But, you know, in France, that doesn't always work so well.
Yeah, I know. I was holding my breath to make sure it would work out okay for you.
they just chalk it up to us being from California, I think. That gives us a little leeway.
Well, now you cover so much territory in this book. As I said, you give the history of getting started. For the record, I've been many times to your cheese store in
the Ferry Building.
Oh, the Ferry Building, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, and you have additional space, I think, since last I saw you. When did you take the additional space next door?
Well, we took that about 3 years ago, and the idea behind that was just to give people really some simple ideas of how to cook with cheese.
Okay, that's
Yeah, that was the idea behind it, and it's just supposed to be really accessible cheese, but also give people some ideas on how to make different grilled cheeses rather than just using the same old cheese that they usually make, and to understand that, wow, I can really get a lot of different flavors by using different ingredients. So that was the whole idea behind it.
You cover, as I said, a lot of territory. You do the history, which is simultaneously a lot of the history of the development of the cheese. I don't know if you call it an industry, but what we call it, business.
cheese business.
Yeah, in this country. And then you do a whole bunch of stuff with milk, which at first I didn't understand what you were doing, but you explain that people don't even think about it the way Europeans do in terms of what they drink as milk.
Right. And no, cheese has four ingredients. You have the milk, the salt, cultures, and rennet. And since there are so few ingredients, each one is so important. And so that's why we really wanted to showcase the milk, because that is the most important ingredient. And it's hard to make you can't make great cheese with not great milk.
Right.
So that's the primary ingredient.
And, of course, the government keeps making it harder, but, you know, we have a lot of raw milk aficionados here in southwestern Pennsylvania, and, of course, they had an outbreak of something, which ultimately, in fine print, turned out not to be the dairy farmer's problem, you know, or fault, but that's how it's listed. So, yeah, you know about that story. You move into compound butters, which I find fascinating. And why did you do that?
Well, we wanted to work from the ground up, basically, and talk about one of the things that's most important in cheese making is what the animals are eating, because those flavors always get transferred to the flavor of the milk, particularly when it's unblended. And so the idea behind that is when you have the fats from the milk and you churn it into butter, that is such a true reflection of what those animals are eating. And so we thought, well, maybe just by showcasing a few compound butters, it really makes people think about the flavor of the butter.
You have also, you have how to plan the cheese course, and you have a whole section of a whole variety of accompaniments to cheese boards.
Right.
Which I think it's interesting, and it's like an all-in-one place resource for people putting together a cheese board.
We just wanted people to think maybe in a new way or just open up their vision of what they can do with a cheese course and what goes well with it, and rather than having it be so regimented, just maybe have an idea that they wanted to convey by serving it. Because Sue and I always think about what we eat since we are cooks, maybe in a way that oftentimes other people don't think of. We like things that really work almost thematically. And so the idea behind this was to just develop a point of view and try and convey it through the cheese board.
Uh-huh. And now I think I know what this photograph is, but it was rather arresting at first glance. The clothesline with the clothes pegs and all these cloths hanging. Is that cheesecloth?
That's the cheesecloth, and that's at a different creamery, but we also use cheesecloth when we're putting some of the curds into the mold so that you can extract it from the mold more easily without it really ripping the rind edging apart. So those are cheesecloths that are used in cheese making.
Well, then there are all these other recipes that certainly show your cooking background, like the cottage cheese dumplings and Parmesan broth. That wonderful panzanella salad with feta.
I love that salad.
Yeah, I do too. And the ricotta asparagus souffle. I mean, all kinds of things that are very useful. And they sound like the recipes that you've really made your own over the years.
Well, they are ones that Sue and I have used a lot, and of course they're the recipes that we gave. We tried to make it be something that isn't so specific to the ingredient, but is more about the idea and the technique.
You outline your individual cheeses that you've made and the order in which you introduced them, and you also talk about photographs. What about this three cheese lasagna with mushroom and spinach?
Well, I love that one. I love lasagna, and actually I learned to cook that when I was at Chez Panisse, cooked the lasagna that style, and Patty Curtin is a person that I worked with a lot at Chez Panisse, and she taught me how to make lasagna that way. And the trick to that lasagna is that you have really thin pasta so that everything comes out really delicately rather than it being real heavy.
Right.
So it's a fun one to try.
Right.
It is labor-intensive, but it's fun.
Now, is there something I'm missing in the cheeses? I mean, you talk about rinds, you talk about aging cheeses. Is there something else that we should relay about the book?
I think the thing for me that's most important is that it shouldn't be an intimidating ingredient. With there's being so many kinds of specialty cheeses now that it's just fun to open up your mind and taste all the different types that people are making. And I think one of the things that's really important with cheese in the U.S. now is that we are so lucky that we don't have such strict boundaries on what kind of cheeses we can make in specific areas, such as they have in France and Italy and Spain. Now, we can be as creative as we want to be and bring those cheeses to market and get a lot of feedback from the consumer. So the cheese industry, if you want to call it that, is in a really good place now for people who are cheese makers, I'd say.
Yeah, it seems a lot of people have said the same thing to us. Max McCalman said the same thing. We talked to him about his, which is wines on one side and cheeses on the other.
Yeah.
But he said exactly the same thing as you said. It seems like a great time to be a cheesemaker. I think a lot of the reason it's a great time to be a cheesemaker is because of pioneers like you and your partner. So let's listen to a round of applause for these fine ladies from Cowgirl Creamery, even if they won't be able to hear you.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for saying that. And I will say that we're super happy that we're part of the business and part of that great community of people that work within it.
And if you want to know more about what to cook with cheese, what cheeses to put together, how to do a cheese board, how to do all that kind of stuff, the Cowgirl Creamery with an embossed Peggy or her partner, I forget which it is. Oh, it's a cutout.
It's a cutout,
okay.
Yeah. The logo.
Sitting on a horse waving a hat, exactly what you would expect. So if you're in San Francisco and you're looking for the best cheese, all you have to do is follow the lady on the horse with a hat.
Yeah.
To very German market.
Peggy,
yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks,
it's been
Peggy.
A pleasure.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So that's a wrap, listeners, for this week. Once again, from all of us here to all of you out there in the world of food, wine, and travel, a very happy holiday to you. We hope you will enjoy what you have to eat and drink and the company that you're with. And all the while remembering that it is Christmas. So what do we say? Until next week.
Bye-bye.